ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In a quaint French village an hour outside of Paris, a group of youngish people from across the world gather together. They take a breath, don red noses, and begin class. Their teacher is Philippe Gollier, one of the world's most famous living clowns.
When he did clown many years ago, like, he was part of like a clown troupe which kind of performed as a clown family, and I think he was sort of like the dad type figure who's sort of like also an idiot, but he's pulling the other idiots into line. In the school, that's replicated a bit.
Inside the clown school, Gollier, who was in his mid-70s at the time, is wearing a beret atop a cloud of grey hair. He peers over his wireframe glasses and is not impressed with his current crop of clown disciples. Here's what he has to say about Laurie, a young woman from Melbourne and the protagonist of our tale. Heads up, this French master clown is shockingly not politically correct.
Sometimes it would be like about me being thin or something, whether my legs looked like little skinny baguettes or whatever it is.
He'd be like, is it beautiful or does she look like a French woman who she forgot to buy the baguette and she's going home to get slapped by her husband?
You know, this sort of stuff.
Gollier also has internationally specific insults.
If you're Australian, for instance, you kind of had to either prove or defend that your humour wasn't like fart humour, you know, and that you weren't an uncultured buffoon, basically.
Hey, I like a fart joke.
He's got this issue with people from Melbourne where he thinks people from Melbourne are wankers, basically. He's been to Melbourne in the past a long time ago and he's kind of like, you know,
every wanker in Melbourne has a theory about something.
At least there are other things we can agree on. I'm kidding, Melbourne. Anyway, I'm Farza Draki, and something I've learnt through making this fine podcast, Days Like These, is that to entertain, one must kill the ego. Here's reporter Hannah Riche, a Melbournean whose ego is in need of the Gollier treatment, with the story of Laurie Lux, unlikely clown.
Laurie grew up far away from the glitz and glam of Paris in Melbourne's inner west suburb of Footscray. Now, Footers has gentrified recently. Guilty, but back in the 80s and 90s when Laurie was living there, it was a very working class, industrial adjacent area, rough around the edges. But Laurie loved living there with her family, who liked to laugh, liked to have fun. Although there was a darker streak running through the family, that's what happens when your patriarch is a die-hard footy fan.
There's a few years ago where I think in the space of 3 or 4 years, Geelong took 3 premierships and they just won a premiership, and I came into the kitchen and he was sitting there with his head in his hands and I was like, hey Dad, what's up? Like, aren't you happy they just won the premiership? And he just turned around and he said, there's always next year.
But amongst all this loudness, the light, the dark, the humour, the footy, Laurie was quiet, very quiet.
My muscles in my mouth weren't that well developed, so I couldn't like blow out a candle or drink from a straw, those kinds of things. So I also couldn't say like the beginning or ends of words very well oftentimes. So I had quite a bad speech impediment where it was not really possible to understand what I was trying to say. And then because I spoke with such a bad speech impediment, some people approach you like you've probably got like, you know, an intellectual disability or something. You know, you're not really motivated to speak after that.
Her mum and her sister and a few close friends could understand her, but she also developed her own ways to communicate.
I used to draw stuff to communicate more. So like my mum was like, what do you want to eat? I'll draw a picture of spaghetti or whatever. So I was quite good at drawing spaghetti by the end of things.
As you can probably imagine, starting school is rough for little Laurie.
I had a bad teacher in grade prep who knew I had a speech impediment. Apparently, from what my mum says, they found out that she'd been calling me like stupid and stuff like that, and made me sit in the corner all year, more or less. So I didn't learn anything in that first year of school.
But the next year, she gets a teacher who actually helps her.
I was really obsessed with dinosaurs at the time, so that teacher like basically to help me keep attention with what we were doing, she made everyone pretty much do dinosaurs for the whole year.
With a focus on dinosaurs, but more importantly, with speech therapy. By around 7 or 8, Laurie is speaking without an impediment.
By the end of the year, I was able to give a speech about these dinosaurs.
By 9, she even finds her shtick.
In the playground as well, I learned to nail a really good Pauline Hanson impression. Like, please explain. Oh God, it sounds really bad now. I think, in my memory, I was really good at it.
But as she grows up, Laurie becomes a little bit shy. That newly found voice quiets. And by early high school, she's now a little bit scared of the world, a little bit nervous. And she's attending an all-girls school in a slightly nicer area and wearing a uniform for the first time.
The waistband, you're meant to wear it like at your hips, but I turned up like looking like Pee-wee Herman with this thing like at my waist with like these socks that were way too big, like up to my knees, like just looking like, you know, like a golfer or something, which did not go down well at this school.
The decision is made to send her to a more creative co-ed local school.
At first, you're really, really trying hard to fit in, and then it doesn't get you anywhere and people aren't very nice to you anyway. So then you're sort of like, well, fuck it, I'll do what I want to do. And then people oddly sort of respect you.
Here, Laurie starts playing with clothing again, raiding op shops, dressing androgynously, embracing clashing patterns, basically letting her freak flag fly. She's also rediscovering performance. Laurie is finding her voice again, but finding the right outlet for her delightful Laurie-ness is still a work in progress. After school ends, she goes to a workshop held by NIDA, the best acting school in the whole country, for recent graduates who are interested in auditioning.
There's a lot of kids who are really into musical theatre who are just super intense, and like the people at NIDA were just very much like, I remember this woman saying to me, she was like, if you don't know why you're here, maybe you shouldn't be here.
It's not her scene. And in her 20s, Laurie stops and starts in a lot of places that aren't her scene either, until she decides on fashion and begins studying at one of the most prestigious courses in Australia.
I always tried to do like the more conceptual modules in the course, because in those you can approach it more like art and you can kind of propose something quite off the wall.
Like in tailoring class, a precise skill that Laurie is absolutely shithouse at.
Tried to think of a way out of having to make stuff that was that precise, you know, because the idea of tailoring is that the clothing has to fit a body. And I was like, well, I'll just skip that whole bit by just proposing to make clothes for something that doesn't have a body. So I was like, what if the clothing wasn't for people? What if the clothing was for like ghosts?
Laurie's ideas are bonkers yet brilliant, but executing them is hard. Organisation not being one of Laurie's strongest points.
Always lose stuff, always forget stuff. Losing the jacket I was about to show in a presentation or something, and I turn around and I'm like, and this is the, oh wait, it's not on the mannequin because I've lost it.
She loses an absurd number of jackets, pants and other garments, and when she seeks help, it turns out she has ADHD. But even with treatment, costly and time-consuming, getting through this high-pressure degree is a real slog. But after she graduates, there's actually interest from someone in buying her final year designs, which weren't for ghosts. It's a huge opportunity, not afforded to many, but she lets it slide. She gets a job in retail and spends a lot of time on a little website called Facebook.
I was a bit addicted to social media or whatever. And I used to always write these like status things on Facebook, you know, usually about my dad.
Like this one.
My dad called me and asked what I wanted, and I asked him to pat the cat in case he was lonely, and he said, give me a break, and hung up.
Look, her dad doesn't love these posts, but other people do.
And then I had a few people say to me like as well, oh, you tell some stories that are funny, why don't you try stand-up?
Laurie goes to a course to learn about the craft of joke writing. Her first set is a 5-minute bit about cats. It kills. She then starts going to open mic nights, a woman in her late 20s treading the sticky carpets of Melbourne's vaunted comedy institutions in probably quite nice shoes, trying out her stuff. Things are falling into place. Well, kind of.
It is inherently quite depressing because there's just a lot of men with depression, basically, in the room wanting to tell you about their dating problems or something, with a lot of like sometimes a lot of like passive aggressive resentment. It's like you have a room full of people, they're waiting to do their set, and then after they do their set, they're on to the next place. And then, you know, if you go to the next place with them, it's the same deal. It's like Groundhog Day. And everyone's just like staring at their phone. They're not even like engaging with what you're doing. It's like public speaking into a closet.
I should point out that we're recording this conversation while Laurie is overseas and literally in a closet. But it isn't just the crowd of sad single dude faces lit only by their phone screens that's the problem. Laurie gets up on stage and often forgets her sets. And even when she remembers them, she quickly gets bored of the repetitive nature of it all. Then she tries improv, where a teacher takes her aside and asks this.
Have you ever considered being a clown? And I was actually like, for a second, almost offended, because in my memory, clowns are like, yeah, Ronald McDonald or something, you know, like, and I thought clowns are a little bit creepy, like most people probably. So I was a bit like, what the hell is she trying to say to me? But then she kind of explained that it was like, well, you know, your work's a bit more physical. Like you do some things with your body that are really funny.
But what the heck is clownery really? Well, that's a bit of a contentious question. It's got a long, rich history, stretching from royal jesters to Patch Adams, and there are many types of clowns. Circus clowns, theatre clowns, the classic red-nosed funny guy, that scary one that lives in a gutter. But in Laurie's mind,
the clown does everything for the enjoyment of the audience. At the heart of things, it's like there's some level of physicality involved, usually. There's a level of vulnerability. It's more like a visceral humour.
So she decides to go to a workshop where she does her very first clown activity. It's simple. Put on a hat and come out and just do something for the audience, preferably something you're not naturally good at. Laurie dons the hat and models it, fumbling along the way. There was some light laughter, but also a lot of non-laughter, also known as silence.
I remember stopping doing it and thinking, like, what the hell have I just done? Like, that's really bizarre. And it was a bit exhilarating. And I remember thinking, wow, that's actually very confronting. I want to try it again. For some people, the idea of it to just like come out and have to do something and have the pressure of that maybe be funny would sound a bit scary, but actually it's quite liberating in a weird way. Maybe it's from not being able to talk when I was younger. I have no idea where the base in it is, but I felt like quite misunderstood at various times growing up. I had this feeling that sometimes people thought I was stupid and didn't understand me, basically. And so then it was like weirdly liberating just to get up and be like, okay, they don't understand me and they probably think I'm stupid, but it's a good thing.
Laurie has finally found her thing. So she stuffs herself into a teeny weeny car and throws herself into clowning. And throughout her training, one name keeps coming up. Gaulier. Philippe Gaulier is the French master clown who has his own cultish clown school.
I was hearing very mixed things. I remember someone in the improv community was like, oh, you shouldn't go there. Like, there was a girl we knew who used to go there and she came back and her performance was, you know, even worse than before she went. And there was someone else who told me about, oh, he forced someone they knew to wear a moustache like for a whole year.
A woman. He's supposed to have forced a woman to wear a moustache for a whole year. And look, F the gender binary, but it's still a big thing to ask of someone, and it's the sort of thing that makes you think twice about whether this is the sort of school you really should be attending. But Laurie goes to see a few people at the comedy festival and is blown away by their theatrical clown comedy, and they had mostly trained with Gaulier. Gaulier had also trained Sacha Baron Cohen, Emma Thompson, and Helena Bonham Carter. The proof was in the pudding. Laurie is intrigued, but not ready to take a pie to the face. She's happy with her life in Melbourne, living with her dad, working in retail.
And a bit also like, am I too old to suddenly try doing this? I had all these fears about it. And also like, I didn't go thinking like, oh, I'm going to be a great clown. So it just seemed a bit random what I was doing.
Laurie is only 30, young to be having a sort of midlife crisis, especially one involving clowning.
I had a few people say to me at least, like, what? Why are you clown school? What are you talking about? You know, like mostly people in comedy were like to me, do you not think that's a bit excessive to spend a year in a clown school?
But then something serious happens. Two young people close to her, her stepbrother and a friend, die. There's intense grief, of course. There's the missing them and the wanting them back. And then there's something else.
They were really positive people who I think would have thought what I wanted to do was really cool and really interesting, and that they would have been really supportive of it. Yeah, I guess I was just really struck by this thing that was like, life doesn't last forever if you find something that's making you happy. So I was just sort of like, all right. That really spurred me on.
She tells her dad about her decision.
He was like, yeah, so you want to go to clown school? And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay, so how are jobs looking on the clown market?
Laurie has already left behind the fashion industry, not known for its easy or solid career path, and is now plunging towards something even more unsteady. Her dad is understandably concerned. Despite her dad's worries and her own reservations, Laurie goes to France. It's 2017, autumn, and Laurie is all alone in a new place.
I tried to teach myself French off Duolingo, which was an absolute joke because I didn't know what the hell I was saying. And at this stage, I think I was still vegan, which obviously, like, yeah, that's a recipe for disaster.
Laughed out of Paris, the city of beef bourguignon and steak tartare, she goes to Étampes, a pretty little village an hour outside of Paris, where L'École Philippe Goulier is based. The school isn't shaped like an enormous shoe. Instead, it's a quiet, modern building. She meets Goulier, and he is exactly what you'd imagine a French clown master would look like. A mess of frizzy grey hair and a beard, little round glasses, beret. In summer, he wears a vest over a shirt. In winter, a cape. He's been running the school since 1980 and isn't the healthiest 70-something-year-old. He shuffles into the room, coughing regularly.
The first time I ever saw him, I think there would have just been a flock of people around him kind of shepherding him here or there. And I think part of that is out of necessity, and then part of that is people being a little bit awestruck. Outside of classes, he's very warm. He will give you like a kiss on the cheek. He will be very sort of like, hello, darling, how are you today kind of thing. It's quite a different thing to then the game that starts once you're in the room.
Now, this is no normal school. They do things a little differently around these parts. Goulier starts most classes with a game.
You all walk around the room, and then when he bangs his drum, you stop. And then if you mess up, you have to admit that you messed up. And then you have to ask your classmates if you can give them a kiss. And then they can reject you or accept you. And you can ask him if you can give him a kiss. Obviously not on the lips, like on the cheek or whatever.
The whole thing sounds a little problematic and potentially humiliating. But look, he's French. A people famous for kissing multiple times just to say hi. And it's all part of le jeu, Goulier's guiding principle that there is a game underneath everything. Just not a game that's particularly enjoyable for everyone at all times.
That's like a double-edged sword sometimes, because if you're going through a tough time at the school and you're not having fun and you can't play, well, then you're going to get plunged further into that sort of negative cycle. But if you're in a good headspace and you're able to play, you can have the most fun you could ever have.
For 5 days a week, for hours each day, Laurie and her fellow students dedicate themselves to the art of clowning and to pleasing their master.
And often what happens in the school is if you get up, you do something, and if it doesn't go well, he bangs the drum and you have to get off the stage. And then you might get to do it again, or you might get insulted. And sometimes you see people having like a real breakthrough. And sometimes it's like breakthroughs not so far from a breakdown. I just mean that like quite literally.
Remember, Laurie is quite new to performance. She doesn't even have the basics down of how to enter and exit a stage.
Yeah, I got slated solidly for the first 6 months.
When he's insulting you, is that throughout the whole time or just when you were really sucking at the basics?
It's all the time, yeah. But it's like if you do something well, he'll tell you you do it well as well. Good things are rewarded, but it's like the good things are not so common.
So why do Laurie and so many others stay? they could easily become clown school dropouts.
The things that he says that are really harsh are important. Like he'll say, if your performance is bad, he'll say, money back, money back, money back. That's the truth. If you put on something that's crap, people are going to ask for their money back. You might get up every week for an audience, you know, an open mic or wherever you perform, theatre, whatever. You might never be told by people why they don't like your performance. He used to say this thing,
everything you do is to make us laughing.
There's this one Shakespeare performance that Laurie does.
He just hated it. It was so relentless. He was like, it's absolutely horrible. It's just eviscerating me. So he asked the other students what they think of you. He's like, you know, was she horrible? Yes. Was her voice bad? Yes.
And what about her body? Is her body shit or whatever?
And of course, they have to answer a certain way because if he doesn't, he'll like hit them with a stick.
But it literally hit them with a stick.
Literally, yeah. But, you know, and he'll call them an idiot.
So Gollier has gotten the entire class to agree that every possible thing about Laurie is shit. But she comforts herself that at least she can still be proud of the handmade costume she's wearing. She is a trained fashion designer, after all.
There's this really polite Canadian guy in the front row. And so then he's like to this guy, he's like,
and her body, is it shit?
And this guy was like, you know, to be honest, I don't think the costume's doing her any favours. And I was like, no, I can't cope with this. Like, you know, it was like the absolutely definition of the straw that broke the camel's back. I was kind of holding it together and I was just like, ah, you know, like dying basically inside. Sometimes those things are really tough, but you just have to come back from it. There's no real other choice.
Most people who say they trained at L'École Philippe Gollier really just do the 3-week course or do a term or two. But Laurie stays for 2 whole years of insults because while she'd already found her thing, now she finally finds the school for her, one that suits her brain and her creativity. By the end of clown school, Laurie finds her own inner and outer clowns. At first, it's a gruff Minnie Mouse who speaks with an exaggerated Australian accent.
When I'm in love, it's like Australia won World War III. When I'm in love, it's like a barramundi killed my father and then I took the barramundi and I said, no, no.
In her second year, her clown becomes more physical and sporty. She lunges like the footy players her dad used to watch warming up.
Like my dad's always listening to sports radio, so I was like, okay, I just talk like these guys do, but I don't know anything about sport, really.
Then later, there's a drag character called Barry.
My name's Barry, better known as Basil Bazza. Fill in for my wife, Beverly Bez, better known as Bezza. So, today we are doing carpentry, sorry, parenting 101.
He's not actually the only character I have called Barry. There's two, which, yeah, I don't recommend doing that. It's a bit confusing, but they're both drag kings as well.
It's esoteric stuff, but what is the reality of day-to-day life as a clown? How is the clown job market? Laurie has been living in London since 2019.
It's as you would probably expect, but London is a good town for it. I'm in a position where I'm sort of like trying to build my career.
Laurie performs, directs, and takes other bits and bobs of work, like being a cat mascot for a week, and often runs workshops in clowning for kids.
It's funny, when I was in Gollier, I definitely felt I was reconnecting to something from my childhood when I would do clown. And I try to keep that energy a little bit when I do it now. For me, it's really important to be understood. And then I start to wonder, wait, is that what's important? Maybe I just need to understand myself and then present something.
Laurie, the little kid who could barely speak, is now a bloody clown, spouting entertaining drivel on stage for strangers. And lately things are coming full circle.
I have some opportunities coming up for me to do work where I won't be speaking at all, just physical work, which is completely different to the other clown work I've done, which was very verbal, very written. And it also just made me realise, oh, I can be super funny without talking at all.
That was Laurie Lux, an Australian clown based in London.
Hannah Reish reported this story, and her favourite clown is Krusty. Sophie Townsend is our executive producer, and as a child, she laughed so hard at the clowns at the circus, she fell forwards into the hard edge of the chair in front, and to this day, still bears a small scar under her left eye. Carrie Dell is our sound engineer, and she has lived a happily clown-free life. I'm Farza Draki, and I'm your resident class clown. This story was produced on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung, Boonwurrung Boonwurrung, and Gadigal peoples. This is Days Like These, the podcast that clowns around.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.